Quer saber de que forma a ciência e a tecnologia estão a alterar, melhorar ou até piorar as nossas vidas? Está no sítio certo. Hoje temos connosco nada mais nada menos do que Jimmy Wales, o fundador da Wikipédia. Bem-vindos ao podcast do Dinheiro Vivo, Made in Tech.
Can you believe it? Can you realize that we, that all of us, have actually begun the exploration of another world?
Olá, eu sou o João Tomé e neste 26º episódio do Made in Tech de 11 de maio de 2021 vamos falar de uma das maiores, não diria descobertas, mas das maiores evoluções do mundo da internet. A Wikipédia foi criada há 20 anos, faz em 2021 20 anos, estávamos na altura no boom das grandes tecnológicas, 2001, e vamos aqui perceber com Jimmy Wales desde logo como é que ela foi criada, porque este modelo sem publicidade, vamos também perceber a utilidade, como se vê nos tempos atuais, do facto de não ter publicidade, depender aqui de donativos. Vamos falar da evolução da plataforma. A verdade é que ainda este ano têm surgido vários artigos, até de especialistas, sobre este tema. A Wikipédia representa hoje em dia o lado mais saudável e puro da internet. E, portanto, de facto, democratizou o conhecimento como nunca ouvimos na história da humanidade. E também a verdade é que não foi sempre assim. No início da sua existência, o meio académico, por exemplo, em 2005, 2006, o meio académico recebeu a Wikipédia com muita desconfiança. E hoje, nos últimos anos, já ganhou uma maior reputação. Porquê? Porque, de facto, também está mais completa e, hoje em dia, é mesmo uma ferramenta base fundamental até para os meios académicos, pelo menos de um ponto de vista de começar um trabalho. A Wikipédia serve aqui como um meio, uma base interessante de perceber como é que funciona, o que é que existe, na verdade, no mundo. É um mecanismo raro também numa era da desinformação, onde as teorias da conspiração parecem ganhar adeptos pelo YouTube, Facebook e companhia. Sobre Jimmy Wales, ele tem um percurso peculiar, ele é norte-americano, vive desde 2019 no Reino Unido, aliás, vive desde 2012 no Reino Unido e ganhou a cidadania britânica em 2019. Ele casou-se com uma inglesa e daí passar a viver também no Reino Unido, e depois ele tem um background curioso, porque trabalhou no mundo da finança, muito ligado também ao início da internet, e aquilo que o motivou acima de tudo foi uma atividade mais colaborativa, humana mais colaborativa, e é isso que está na base da Wikipédia. Vamos falar sobre ele, sobre esse tema, sobre o crescimento da plataforma, a forma como também tem uma base filosófica. Um dos cofundadores da Wikipédia, Larry Sanger, era filósofo, portanto tem um lado também de ligação à filosofia, e falar como, por exemplo, neste momento só a China bloqueia a Wikipédia, portanto é o único sítio do planeta onde ela não está disponível. Vamos depois também falar nos tempos atuais de internet, um lado mais negativo que temos visto na internet, portanto, associado às redes sociais, como a Wikipédia pode também aqui ajudar. Na verdade, Jimmy Wales tem um projeto relacionado com esse tema, que é o Wikitribune, aliás, agora chama-se WT Social. Ele vai falar porquê o lançar esse projeto em 2017 e também o que é que correu mal nele, porque de facto ele não conseguiu cumprir aquilo que era suposto cumprir, tornar-se aqui uma ferramenta de jornalística colaborativa. De facto, não funcionou como ele já viu, e vamos tentar perceber porquê. Percebemos também um certo ódio de estimação que ele tem a Rupert Murdoch, o magnata de vários meios de comunicação, especialmente nos Estados Unidos, mas também na Austrália, aliás, tem mais até na Austrália. Ele tem um ódio de estimação e, por isso, ele não é grande fã do código australiano que fez, obrigou aqui Facebook e Google a pagarem um certo valor aos meios de comunicação social. Vamos também analisar também aquilo que poderá ser os próximos 10 anos da Wikipédia, o que é também interessante. Há uma nova forma da Wikipédia receber dinheiro dos gigantes tecnológicos, além dos donativos, e isso foi lançado este ano. Vamos também analisar um bocadinho esse tema. E, portanto, temos aqui muitos temas de conversa interessantes com Jimmy Wales. Sem mais demora, segue então a conversa.
Where does this podcast find you?
Ah, I am in my attic, as you can see, at home in England.
London?
I'm actually outside London, so I'm in the Cotswolds.
Countryside.
Countryside, yeah.
Just to start, I was wondering, because of course you probably told this story many times, but it's always good to reflect a little bit. 20 years since the start of Wikipedia this year, January. How a guy like you that were more in finance started a project like Wikipedia, which is a nonprofit. Sure. How did it all came about? 20 years.
So I was in finance, but I was always a computer programmer. I always say not a very good one, but I was a computer programmer, and I was really, really interested in the growth of the internet. So I had been active on the internet when I was in grad school, very intrigued by what was going on, saw that it was beginning to be a real, you know, force and a revolution. So I wanted to move kind of into entrepreneurship. And I'm from a family of entrepreneurs. My mother and my uncle both started businesses, and my mom and dad later started a pharmacy and so on. So it felt very natural to me to be an entrepreneur. And then, you know, did a few things during the dot-com boom, but really Wikipedia was the big success. So it's quite exciting.
You started, when was the time where you started to see this is a winner in terms of people getting excited about it? You had a lot of contributors also to the project. Was a boom?
Yeah, so 2 years before Wikipedia started, I set up a project called Newpedia, which was an effort to create a free encyclopedia. And people were excited about that. We had a good community that was growing up, but we didn't really know how to do it. We didn't have the software right. We didn't have the community structures right. And so once I launched Wikipedia in 2001, in 2 months, we had as much work done as we had done in 2 years. I mean, it was really phenomenal that this method of an open system where people could jump in and correct things and build things, that our community was able to really do something quite interesting.
It's curious to see that you had also a collaborator, Larry Sanger, right? He was a developer like you also, but a philosopher, I heard. Was there, in terms of the building of the infrastructure of the first steps, philosophy part that you thought in terms of society? Where is our internet society going, and what type of project can we contribute to?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I thought a lot about what would it mean to be an encyclopedia. What makes a quality encyclopedia? How do we know things? Neutrality has always been a really core value for Wikipedia, to not take sides on controversial issues, but to explain them so that people can come to their own decision. So all of those things were very consciously created, yes.
When we see now what happened, it was groundbreaking, because at that time you had Google that was starting to monetize their website. Monetization was a big thing, of course, for this project. And here were you non-monetization model. Was that difficult in the beginning to convince people to get aboard when they saw that they wouldn't get rich with it?
No. Quite the opposite. I mean, first of all, we operated without any paid staff for a very long time. So we were a volunteer movement before I set up the Wikimedia Foundation, which is the charity that operates Wikipedia. And so, you know, people came to Wikipedia to create an encyclopedia. Always has been a volunteer project. In a sense, none of those people ever thought about, you know, really, oh, we should try and make $1 billion out of this. Like, that just was not a thing we were thinking about. We were just a group of geeks trying to build something new and fun and cool on the internet. So it was really, you know, that was completely fine. Now, of course, it was hard, you know, in the early days to figure out, like, how are we going to pay for more servers, right? So when Wikipedia really started to grow, that was when I decided to put it into the nonprofit organization, because I was paying for all these servers and it was getting to be expensive. And this was, of course, the depths of the dot-com crash. So there was no real obvious revenue model. So I set up the nonprofit, and then a few months later, we had our first fundraiser, and we were hoping to raise $20,000 in 30 days, but we had raised $30,000 within about 2 weeks. So It was a big success, and we were able then to buy 8 servers in that first batch of servers, and it was all very exciting.
But there was never an idea of putting advertising in it. Did you know what advertising... No, now we all talk about advertising, the algorithms, Facebook. Yeah. But back then, that wasn't the main topic. How did you come about in terms of advertising isn't that good for this project?
Well, I mean, I always opposed advertising on aesthetic grounds. It just didn't seem right for the project. And especially back then, there were a lot of blinking stupid ads and pop-ups and all that. And so I just thought, okay, I don't really want ads. And for a long time, we didn't. In fact, I don't think we've ever said definitively we will never have ads. What we say is we don't want to have ads. So we have to sort of think about fundraising. We have to think about how we can make Wikipedia successful otherwise. And we've been very successful in that. But, you know, for me, it was really, of course, I didn't have any idea about all of the very complex questions that we're facing today around tracking and data and sort of algorithmic influence hacking our brains and so on. It was really just like, no, I like Wikipedia without ads. So let's just try and figure out how to do that.
Of course, and you didn't want to get rich with it, so it wasn't a main purpose to have the best way to monetize the platform.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's interesting. I read an article in 2007, an academic article that said Wikipedia cannot be trusted because it's not it don't have the best information. But for example, a couple of years ago, MIT did a study where most academics suggest their students to go to Wikipedia to start the beginning of a process. Yes. Of academic process. So things change in terms of the awareness of what is Wikipedia is, and of course the growth, especially in English, but also in some languages, of better articles, more information helped that. But are you satisfied with this 20 years of evolution?
It's been really good. What I always say about that, though, is that we were never as bad as they thought we were. And we aren't as good as they think we are. So we still have a long way to go. We want to be better. We want to make Wikipedia as high quality as possible. And, you know, a lot of what's happened over that time period has been an increase in the quality of Wikipedia. We've just had more time to work on it and so on. But also it's an increased understanding that, okay, actually, Wikipedia is pretty good on many topics. And, you know, I think it was a little surprising to people in the early days to see sort of warnings like the neutrality of this article has been disputed, or, you know, the following section doesn't cite any sources. And it wasn't viewed as a positive for quality. But now people are like, no, actually, that is a positive quality. Like, Wikipedia warns you if there's a problem, and we wish other places would. So.
Of course, now we've seen even social media platforms doing something similar with some, especially with COVID and the pandemic, more advertising if something is disputed, of course. So things are evolving to a more Wikipedia, probably, like even in social media, of course.
In a way, different. Of course, the huge difference is that all those platforms are very top down in terms of their moderation. The community really doesn't have any control. Whereas in our case, everything you see on the website is 100% from the volunteer community. So, you know, there's all of the blocking, all of the decisions that are made. They aren't made by the Wikimedia Foundation. It's really made by this community of volunteers in a democratic process. So that's kind of amazing, really.
I was curious about, I interviewed a Wikimedia contributor in Portugal, the biggest contributor in Portugal. He was saying to me how things have evolved in terms of the platform they use for to put the information there. Things are getting better and better, of course, with more more donations to the platform. What were the biggest changes, even technology-wise, to Wikipedia in the last years?
Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest changes is the shift from wiki markup language to a more visual editor. That took a long time and is now, you know, the more popular way of contributing. I still use the old wiki editor because I'm old fashioned. But in general, that sort of making it technologically easier to participate has been really quite important. But you know, there are other elements, but it's in many ways, it's kind of purely the same as it ever was. In other words, we don't have algorithms writing articles or suggesting articles. We just have people figuring out what to do and building it.
Of course, and it's getting bigger and bigger. Catherine Mayer is beginning to, I think she's leaving this month as a CEO of Wikimedia. What do you think was her role, given that in terms of donations, they grew for $141 million now? Yeah. So they grew almost doubled.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, she's been a fantastic CEO, and, you know, it's time for her to move on, which I regret, but, you know, she's got her own career to build, and that's exciting. And, yeah, fundraising has gone really well. I mean, now we're stable. You know, we'll always have to be serious about fundraising. It's quite important. But we find that most donors are really happier to donate when Wikipedia feels stable. Like, you don't want to donate money if it's going to go out of business. You want us to be safe. And so that appeal to people has been very strong. And of course, I think part of the reason that our fundraising has gone well in recent years is this sense that something's gone wrong around social media, that around the quality of information people are receiving. So fake news or, you know, politicians. I mean, we had a huge bump in donations immediately from the day that Donald Trump was elected, because people were realizing, like, actually misinformation is bad, and we really need to have access, the public needs access to quality information so that we can make quality decisions in society.
Of course, it's like a basis where you can go to see how information is precise. It's funny, even funny if you think about it, how so much information, we have now so much information that misinformation is more attracted. People are more attracted to misinformation. There are studies that say it is true. So you need with the not non-sexy information, which is the real one, available definitely to everyone. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you know who will be the next CEO of Wikimedia?
No, we're just at the beginning of the search process. I just got off a call just before I called you, and I was chatting with one of our senior executives about how the process is going, but there's nothing to announce for a while.
Okay. I was curious also about what's next for Wikimedia. But before that, there were some talks about problems in terms of presidents trying to mine Wikipedia in terms of the information that is there, even with Brazil, Bolsonaro and others. What are the main challenges for Wikipedia nowadays, given that officials in some countries are trying to mine the good information, let's say like that?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really had much problem with governments trying to impact Wikipedia. I mean, we have in the past, we've had blocks in various countries. That situation has improved to some extent, although we're still blocked in China,
for example,
but we were blocked in Turkey, and now we've won a Supreme Court case there, and we're not blocked in Turkey. Mm-hmm. And so in general, we think the biggest challenges are always to think about community health. You know, are the volunteers happy? Are they having fun? Are they doing good quality work? Do we have a thoughtful dialogue in the community, and, you know, people are finding it a rewarding experience to participate? And so that's really a lot of focus of our thinking and our work.
Of course, makes sense. There's new projects in terms of that area to expand a more diverse, even in terms of countries, of articles, languages. Do you have projects ongoing in that area?
Yeah. I mean, it's largely driven by the community. So people, you know, do projects we call it a wiki project. So wiki project to, you know, increase the content about a certain country, or actually one of my favorite is Wiki Project Women in Red, which is about making sure that prominent women are well covered in Wikipedia. So there's a lot of great work that goes on like that to really step back and examine, okay, where are we with Wikipedia? Where are the holes? What do we need to fill? You know, how do we get more volunteers active and involved in certain areas?
20 years, you probably have so many stories of feedback, even of user feedback over the years. What was the main feedback that you had that you were more surprised, more overwhelmed? you have any remembrance of it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. I mean, I remember once, one of the things I like to do when I'm traveling, which I've unfortunately, I'm in my attic, so no traveling these days, but is I like to visit schools in the developing world and to really think about education and access to knowledge by all the people who are coming online for the first time. And it was really impressive to me. I was once in the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. I was giving a speech there, and I went to visit a very poor neighborhood, and there was a community center they had built that had a computer lab. So this was an area that just 3 years before didn't have any electricity. And now the kids were on computers doing, you know, after school, they were doing their homework and they all knew Wikipedia and YouTube and, you know, and it was to see, okay, these are people who just a few years before would have had almost no access to knowledge. You know, the schools are poorly resourced, not a lot of books and so on. And suddenly they have the entire world at their fingertips. And that's kind of an amazing thing, you know, and of course they were amazed to meet me and all of that. And that was kind of fun. But in general, I mean, for me, that's the kind of feedback that I think is like, wow, like it's quite incredible what's going on.
It's a little bit like magic, right? For those children, Wikipedia is a little bit like magic. They were closed in the real world where they didn't have access to outside the world. And with the internet and Wikipedia in there, they have all this access, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It opens possibilities for them even.
It opens possibilities, yeah, exactly.
In terms of the biggest challenges for the next couple of years, I've read a few weeks ago that Wikimedia will launch Wikimedia Enterprise to get some money, of course, from big tech. They use every day, big tech uses Wikipedia for information, Apple Siri, and of course, Alexa, Google Assistant, all our assistants. Even when you search Google something, Wikipedia is one of the biggest sources of information. You're trying to monetize in some way that influence that Wikipedia has for this big tech, right?
Yeah. I mean, the idea is basically, you know, we create and give away, we the community create and give away a free encyclopedia to everyone. So we're happy that we're part of all those services. That's not a problem, right? So we're not trying to stop them from doing it. What we are trying to do is to say, okay, let's think about ways, given that it is free, freely licensed, so they have every right to do that. That's part of our ideas and that we want it to be free. But what are the services that would help them do that job better that they could pay for to help cover the infrastructure costs and sort of fund the movement more? And it's going to be an interesting project. You know, we know that they have approached us in the past on purely technical matters of like, well, we're trying to use Wikipedia data for this, but it's hard to get it in this format. And we can say, okay, well, we can help with that, but you're going to have to pay for it. Like we're, you know, we're a charity for the world, not for big tech. And so I think it's, you know, it's too early to say exactly what the shape that will take, but I think it's a very promising initiative.
But in terms of revenue of finances, it will be probably good. I think the project for this year, you expect $140 million in terms of donations. Probably it will grow from this new area.
Yeah, and I don't even know if the staff have a really good projection yet on how much we think we might get, but it won't be anywhere. It won't be competing with donations, and I think we wouldn't really want it to. I mean, we really want the core revenue to still always be the donations from ordinary people, because nobody wants Wikipedia to be sort of captive of big tech. Of course, we just want them to chip in their fair share. So,
of course. Makes sense. In terms of that money that will come, do you think it can help new projects getting faster? What types of projects could that be in terms of more money you have to invest?
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's a lot of really interesting things that we should be doing and could be doing, particularly in terms of supporting the growth of the Wikipedia communities in the developing world. Really, you know, there are a lot of parts of the world that are coming online in great numbers, but they aren't yet participating in Wikipedia in great numbers. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to be really focused on helping them to do that. And that's often some technical challenges. It's often just getting to be known there. It's getting support through universities in the developing world and supporting them and their efforts and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of elements of that, because for us, ultimately, we are a charity. And our goal is a free encyclopedia for every single person on the planet. And so I'm excited if we can have more revenue to pursue those goals.
Mm-hmm. I was also curious about what you think of the brand new, it's not brand new, but it's more mediatic topics about Facebook, Google, in terms of the, there are some studies that say, even internal documents that were leaked out that say that Facebook, for example, even YouTube, can help to radicalize, polarize more a society. Of course, in the United States, it's more about politics, Republicans, Democrats. But in other countries, is only sometimes conspiracy theories. Bill Gates is behind coronavirus. And yes. I think what is shocking for even for journalists today is to see how intelligent people online can be more radicalized sometimes. With these algorithms that promote engagement. And we know that our natural beings engage more in more divisive content. It's normal to engage in things that we don't like. So that content is more promoted on social media. More people will see it, think they it's true because so many people are talking about it.
So, I mean, so for me, I mean, I think I kind of break it down like this. I think that... as we are human beings, we are multiple layers. We're complicated. We want to sit back and learn and reflect and chew on ideas and come to the truth. And we also want to click on something that's appealing in the moment, right? And that's both are very human. And the internet provides us with both, but unfortunately, social media is really pandered towards those reptile sort of instincts of click on this, click on that. And I think it's a problem. And I think these companies are, you know, no one is deliberately thinking, oh, let's radicalize people to believe in conspiracy theories. That isn't how it works. Instead, their algorithms have inadvertently pursued that because of what you say, it's sort of the natural tendency. And I think it's a huge problem. And I believe these companies are really thinking hard about the problem, but I think they're going to struggle to solve the problem because that is a human tendency. And if your business model is pure advertising, then you just need people to be on the site as long as possible, and you're going to be tempted in this direction. So I don't really have a solution, except, you know, as consumers, we should be aware of this phenomenon and turn away. And of course, what I always try to remind people, though, is that there's some really interesting other things going on in big tech. So at the same time, we have all of this short firm, you know, attention based, you know, TikTok and Twitter and short, and this. We also have the growth on, it's really a golden age of serious, thoughtful television with long form content, you know, that you say, it's not unusual now to say, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch a 12-hour series that's really high quality drama and very thoughtful and very intelligent. And so that's also big tech. And so
even, you know, podcasts,
let's engage more.
Even podcasts
is a really good example, good example that with podcasts, I was actually thinking about this today. I was thinking about, I used to never be into podcasts, but because of lockdown, and which we're coming out of now in the UK, but I still spend a lot of my time out here in the countryside. But the children have gone back to school in London, and so I drive back and forth. And so when I'm driving on my own for 2 hours, I love a good podcast that really digs into deeply into an issue And I think that's a really wonderful thing. And again, that's that other layer of human being that is part of technology.
Yeah, in one conversation, Clubhouse, the success of Clubhouse shows us that people want a conversation, sometimes long conversation.
I mean, it's interesting. I've heard of Clubhouse. Of course, everybody just assumes I know everything about everything on the internet. But I have an Android phone, and they're only on iPhone.
Exactly.
So I'm waiting for the Android client.
Of course, I think you will probably get a version of Clubhouse on Facebook, on Twitter, first than Clubhouse having an Android app, I think.
That might be.
But also, I was curious in terms of, we've seen documentaries, like we were saying, even on Netflix, like Social Dilemma, where you see how these platforms work and how... exactly, advertising is not helping them to go to a better way. But for example, even Twitter has already announced that they are open to have academics going to their information to try to see what their algorithms are doing to society. For example, Facebook doesn't have that approach. They don't want anyone near that information.
Yes.
They sometimes, even in the recent weeks, they try to present some studies, not from them, not from real information from them normally, but some studies that show, oh, society is polarized since 30 years ago. So it's a big, big thing. But I see Twitter more open to have academics searching for this than Facebook. Do you think even Apple is trying to get more rules in terms of tracking and transparency? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few interesting things in all of that. So first of all, I think these companies need to focus on the problem, because if they focus only on their short-term business interests, then they won't try to solve these problems. But I've said to people at Facebook in particular that it's really bad for your business in the next 20 years if people come to believe that you're breaking Western democracy. Like, that's not healthy for you as a company. If you're blamed for all the troubles of the world, you're going to have a problem selling advertising in the long run. And they're aware of that, I hope. And then the other thing is, like, Apple is actually a really good example of something that I've talked about a lot, which is that I think that ultimately, your business model can drive you in a certain direction. And the thing about Apple, and of course, Apple's a huge company. I can say things I criticize and things I like about Apple. So I'm not a cheerleader in one way or the other. But one thing that is very interesting is Apple makes most of their money selling beautiful hardware. And they care about customers in a different way because of that. And so they have an incentive to say, actually, if we see that the public is not happy about being tracked, well, we don't make money from tracking people. We make money from selling them hardware. And so whatever they want in the hardware, we're going to help that happen. And I think that's good. That's healthy. That's competition in a way. I'd like to see more competition across the board. I think it's unfortunate we've got a level of concentration across the industry, really. But I think that's good and that's important. And, you know, that will... If that's successful and people say, oh, why did you buy an iPhone instead of an Android? Oh, well, because this, then Google, which has a mixed kind of complication, they may say, okay, well, we need to do something and so on. So,
of course, it makes sense. I was also curious to talk to you about news, what news are today. You, of course, have a project, Wiki Tribune, that is now called WT Social. We've seen also, even in the pandemic, one thing I think is very interesting is that even Facebook or YouTube started to get the algorithms to get more push to what they called authoritative information. So news outlets with more more focus, the algorithms promote more information of authorities, of news outlets. That was in a brief moment. It was for a few months, but that happened. So people, if this worked out, got more better information, let's say, like that, on these platforms because of the pandemic. Do you think that could be a way of these platforms going in terms of creating more incentives to authoritative information. I say this because, for example, when I do a big report, which is very important for our local community, for our country, sometimes in Facebook it gets zero clicks. But when I push something more easy to do and more with a extreme right guy, and then you get so many clicks. So
I do think so, but I also I think for them it's a real challenge, because they can start to guide people, but they can't necessarily change that human element of so there was a time period when I made a personal commitment. I'm not going to click on any news headline that promises to tell me what Donald Trump tweeted last night. It's not helping my life. Like, I'm sure I'm going to be angry. I'm sure I'm going to be upset. There's no point in it. I can't do anything about it, and it's not actually information. But you know, that's hard. And people, you know, again, it's that dual nature of humans. But I do think that these platforms, they should think about the quality of information that they're promoting. They should really reflect on if their algorithm is accidentally driving engagement with extremist views and radicalizing people. That's a problem. At the same time, you know, I think we should step back and reflect on, you know, it's a very funny kind of world we're in if we're begging Facebook, please help shape our understanding of the world by promoting content that you think is of quality, because that may not be, you know, so great well. So it's complicated.
It's complicated, yeah. Europe has a number of measures, especially Margaret Vestager. We have interviewed her in the beginning of the year about Digital Act and the Markets Act. She says that, of course, these proposals that try to, for example, to put online what is illegal offline, illegal also, but other measures even for academics to have more access to algorithms and something like that. And the bargaining in each country where when people don't agree with these platforms, they can contest them. But she said that, of course, this in Europe, this takes a lot of time. Probably these measures will take 2-3 years, which is the way Europe does things. What do you think of these measures, given that you were very critical to the Article 13 before?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you have to take each measure as it is and analyze it and think it through. But there's a very very poor track record, I would say, of politicians taking actions that are actually useful. And there's been a tendency to neglect some of the unfortunate side effects. So I'll just give an example. Last night I randomly got interested in a murder case. It's really not important, right? An interesting murder case in America, and it all sounded like a mystery, and I was curious about it. So I started Googling some of the names, and I found that several of the newspaper articles are not available here, and it's because of GDPR. Mm-hmm. And that was never an intention of GDPR, but right now there's over 800 newspapers that you can't access from Europe. And they're generally small town newspapers who are just afraid of the problem. Okay, so sometimes when I tweet about this, people say to me, oh, well, those papers should stop violating our data rights. And I'm like, it's a small town newspaper somewhere. They're not really likely to be doing anything terrible. And by the way, if you think GDPR is preventing Facebook from doing bad things with your data, I think you're probably very naive. Exactly. And so that's the kind of example where I would say, okay, I don't disagree with the intention of the law. I think privacy is important, thinking through ownership of data, ownership of information about us is very important. Actually, I recommend very strongly, I just watched it this week, there's a documentary called Coded Bias on Netflix, which is about algorithms and bias, and it's mainly about facial recognition. But it really is eye-opening to think about, okay, what are the problems of some of these technologies? And also then how should we think about the use of these technologies in society? You know, in particular, the documentary really highlights how the algorithms perform very poorly on certain types of people, and also generates a lot of false positives. So young black men get harassed in the street by police because a computer thinks they're the wrong person. It's very much a live issue that people should be aware of.
Of course, Europe has put in order some guidelines in terms of AI, probably trying to deal with some things like that. I was curious, in the news department, you talked a little bit against the Australian code, the bargaining code, where Facebook and Google should share their money, let's say like that, from advertising with news media outlets. Of course, I interviewed Rod Sims, which is the father of the bargaining code. He responded to the critics, saying that they identified a problem. So society in Australia is getting worse information from social media. Most of them take their information from social media. So there's the source of information, and they see some radicalization in society also. So they try to promote better journalism. That's the main goal, better journalism, giving these media outlets some rules that they have to have some types of news. It cannot be, for example, sports. It's not included. They have some rules about it. Of course, he said to me that their bargaining act is very focused on Australia and the guidelines and the structure of Australia news media outlets, which are more organized than in some other countries. But it's a beginning, a start, and there are some other countries trying to see if that's possible. What do you think of this area, given that the model for journalism, for news media outlets, it's ruined in terms of advertising? It's completely out of shape and getting in the down.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the Australian law is a fantastic way to give a lot of money to Rupert Murdoch to continue destroying democracy around the world. I think it's a disastrously bad idea. And I think that in large part, of course, Murdoch has a huge amount of power in Australia and will use whatever sort of flimsy kind of arguments to give himself an advantage over smaller competitors in that market, and also to just get some money from Facebook and so on. So, I mean, what I would say is, look, if as a society we want to tax social media and subsidize news, Rupert Murdoch, I think we should be much more transparent about it and not pretend that it's about a bargaining code, and also not break the very fundamental concept, which is that linking to something is not a copyright violation, that it's pointing people towards something. And the newspapers benefit enormously from the traffic they get from Google and Facebook. And so I just think the structure of it was quite wrong, and the political motivation was quite wrong.
Actually, Rod
while
seems
acknowledging the problem, of course, the problem, you know, this idea that in particular local newspapers have been very much destroyed. But for me, I think the solution is actually emerging. The solution is around people paying for news. I think that is a trend that's very strongly emerging, and I think that's very helpful. And, you know, I think, you know, a lot of these, it's very easy. You know, the thing about the negotiation power, it's very easy for any newspaper, if you don't like the traffic that you get from Google, just opt out. It's very simple. Google doesn't mind. So you can threaten to withhold the news from Google, and that will be fine with them.
But actually, his perspective, Rod Sims, which created the code, was a little bit, he told me that it wasn't about the links on Facebook. That was a little bit talked about even in the US, but that wasn't the Australian area of seeing. It was more to promote good news without being even linked on Google or Facebook. So they completely say they are discriminating news outlets in order to get better news, discriminating, giving them an advantage that other companies don't have taken out, of course.
And China does the same thing. China definitely subsidizes news that they like.
They control news they don't like.
I think it's a very problematic approach. Yeah, I wouldn't want Donald Trump deciding which newspapers are getting money in the United States. So of course, I think this is a key issue.
Problematic for you, yeah. In terms of the project, the WT Social, it didn't come about as you expected, given that you were trying to have probably a bigger impact, hiring journalists, trying to create a Wikipedia for news. How did that project evolve since 2017, I think?
Yeah, so Wiki Tribune, so it's WT Social, so WT.social, but it's Wiki Tribune Social. We just found a short domain name. I was really excited about that. Is basically, it's an effort to sort of really look at collaboration, information, news information in particular, and what is the best way for a community to engage in a new way. And so we started out with a much simpler model of just, okay, let's start. We'll create a news publication that people can participate and edit. And as we were building that and doing that, we realized really a couple of things. So one, there wasn't really, it's not so easy for ordinary people to participate in most news reporting simply because they don't have the time and the access and so on. It's a lot easier to write an encyclopedia because the sources are there and you're writing something that's evergreen for the long term. But then the other thing we realized is that really the problem isn't around the writing of the news or the journalism. It's around the whole ecosystem being broken. Mm. It's exactly, you know, what you say. You can publish a really serious, thoughtful piece, and it may not get as much traffic as a fluffy little thing that costs nothing to write. Exactly. And that's part of that whole ecosystem. And so what I want to do is say, okay, let's build a new ecosystem that rewards thoughtful quality information. So where we've got not algorithms deciding and not me deciding, but a group of community members deciding, okay, this is good quality, this is bad quality, we can improve this, we can improve that, to begin to build a new kind of ecosystem. It's still very much a pilot project. I mean, we're working on the software constantly, trying to make the site faster. It's a little bit too slow at the moment because we're sort of draft 1.0. But I'm excited about it. I think in a few years' time, we're going to be on something quite interesting.
For now, it's more focused on the UK, right? In terms of...
No, it's really global. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, global. Global. I mean, I would say we're strongest in English language and in German language. We've got quite a lot of German users. Mm-hmm. But there's other languages as well.
I was curious also about what you think the future of journalism, given that, for example, I give you the example of Portugal. Of course, subscription models are getting bigger in journalism, but people in Portugal are more used to not paying for news. And this is an habit that is difficult to take from them. So it's not easy to take a lot of money with subscriptions in a small country.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a real challenge. I mean, I think some of the things that have been very helpful is it's become a lot easier for people to pay using just, you know, very simple click and pay and so on.
Exactly.
So that you're able to have an impulse purchase and to buy more easily. And I think that's very helpful because oftentimes the hardest part about paying a small amount for something is just the trouble of typing in your credit card number and everything. Mm. And I think so as we improve payment methods, I think that makes it possible for people to pay small amounts. But also I just think when people begin to see the difference, in the quality of what they're seeing, you say, okay, well, I can follow the random clickbait nonsense that comes across, right? Or if I really want something of quality, I'm willing to pay for it. I think it's going to take some time, but I don't think it's this magic solution to everything, but I think it's incredibly helpful.
We've seen this, it's a current, I would say, in the US especially, with everything being by subscription. Google is trying to maximize the services they have in terms of subscription. For example, Google Photos will not have a free part where you can unlimited put your photos in the future. So there are subscription to exercise now, to even for mobility probably. So subscription is getting gaining more and more traction, I would say. Of course, you, after a while, you will be competing with a broad sense of services by subscription, not only Netflix, Prime, or HBO, but with a lot of other services. So I think we'll probably get in an area in terms of subscription where people must decide what is more important for them, because almost everything will be by subscription, right?
I think we'll have a mix, but yes, I think that's right. Wikipedia will be free.
Exactly. Given that, I was interested what you see the next 20 years of Wikipedia being. Of course, free is on the basis of the project, of course, but where do you see the project going, interconnecting with other people, with society, really? And we're talking about a more radicalized society. Can Wikipedia have a role, bigger role on more informed society?
I think Wikipedia is incredibly popular all around the world. It's more popular than any newspapers. And basically what I would say is that a lot of the changes that will happen in Wikipedia in the next 5, 10, 20 years will be invisible to most people, because it will be about the growth in the developing world. Mm-hmm. So you and I may not notice when Swahili Wikipedia becomes comprehensive and thorough and 1 million entries and so on, because, well, I don't know about you, but I don't speak Swahili, and so I can look at it, but I don't know anything about it. And so that kind of thing will go on. I think that, in terms of the site, obviously over time we'll modernize the interface a little bit here and there, just because keep up with technology. But we won't become, YouTube. We're not going to turn into a video site, or we're not going to become TikTok, it's an encyclopedia, and we're happy with it as it is.
Of course, makes sense. Given that, like you were saying, we live in a more quick society. People want an easy fix with news, with likes, with things like that. In terms of education, where do you think education can be a good part of having a better solution? Literacy, social media, and media literacy can be a big part of people getting more aware of how the internet works and how can they avoid the problems.
I think this is crucially important. I think it needs to be part of a really core part of all education today, is media competence, teaching learners of all ages, how do you think about information? How do you think about the quality of information they're receiving? How do you evaluate it? What is interesting is, we all tend to have a bias and we think, oh, young people are going to be easily deceived. But it turns out the older generations are more easily deceived in many ways. Mm-hmm. The young people have grown up with, they know something random that came across Facebook might be an idiot, and old people tend to be more trusting. So I think all elements of society need to have some media competence education.
Makes sense. There's studies that say that in Finland, when they started to teach children that what is this information, what are the main sources of information where we can get a better information, even the adults, the fathers, the grandfathers, started to be less engaged on schemes, on criminality online, for example, phishing. I think Finland in Europe has a better track record of not falling in phishing. And I think they think that the guidelines they get into children help.
I think
that's
exactly right. I think that's exactly right, because children teach their parents more than we realize. Yeah. No, it's interesting because my family, well, we're pretty tech savvy, but it's just like any family. My mother got a weird text message and said, oh, I'm worried about this text message. They say I owe money. And we're all said, don't click the link. Don't click the link. Whatever you do, if you think you might owe some company money, go to the company directly, go on Google and find them and then ask them. Don't click the link. And so I think that's definitely a thing.
We have two or three wishes for the internet as a whole. and our society as a whole for the next couple of years, what would that be? Where do you think we should be going next in terms of internet in a broader sense?
Yeah, so I mean, for me, it's I'm thinking it's time to turn to more thoughtful and deeper engagement things, and to recognize that the fluffy, lightweight social media isn't really all that great and isn't what it's all about. So I'll give an example. My family, during lockdown, we started doing a weekly quiz. So a different family member makes the questions every week, and we do a quiz every week. And what's nice about that is that we actually are on video every week. We're talking to each other. You know, some of my, you know, my one sister who I really wasn't talking to all that much, no problems, but just, you know, life is life and you move on. And suddenly I see her every week and we joke around, and it's been really healthy and really good. And I say to people, just think about what that means to get on with grandma and all the kids and the grandkids once a week and joke around and laugh and see each other, compared to clicking like on a picture of my sister's dog on Instagram, right? Which is the weakest kind of social interaction possible. Even though there's nothing wrong with clicking like on a dog picture, that's okay, but it's not very much. It's not interesting. So I'm turning in that direction. And in fact, one of the things I've done during lockdown, I've created a new website called quiznightbeyond.com, which isn't launched yet, but if you go there, you can put your email address in and I'll email you when it's finished. But the idea is to sort of have that, to say, let's do video quizzes together. It's just a silly little side idea, but I think it's quite powerful to think about. Let's think about over the next few years, how do we, given that everybody's comfortable doing Zoom meetings, which we're on right now, what can we do that's more human than just clicking on, you know, don't click on your sister's dog picture. Call her up and have a video chat. So.
That's interesting. I was also wondering, of course, there's a new generation in town, like we say. What advice would you give nowadays to your 20-year-old self nowadays, which is starting their life with others, a different society that you had 20 years ago?
Gosh, I mean, I it's a good question. I wouldn't presume to advise. I know what I would tell my 20-year-old self if I could go back in time. I would say, buy Apple stock. the only thing you really need to know. But no, I mean, I think, you know, I do think there's something really interesting about trying to grapple with the cell phone and social media in a different way, and to try to break away from certain addictive behaviors that are just a waste of time. And so, you know, I think TikTok's quite fun and there's nothing wrong with getting on TikTok, but after a while you should probably delete it and go watch some long form, you know, TV content, or go and read a long piece in a quality newspaper.
Of course, yeah, makes sense. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you. Great, lovely.
It was a good talk.
Great. And yeah, lovely.
Have a good week.
Very good. Thank you.
Bye bye.
E pronto, está feito. Lembro apenas que vamos ter uma segunda parte deste episódio, que vamos publicar já amanhã, em que temos aqui um dos principais colaboradores da Wikipédia em português, o português Gonçalo Temudo, que é um biólogo e que já há vários anos que colabora, portanto, fornece aqui a um dos editores de serviço da Wikipédia em português. Vamos falar com ele, acima de tudo, como é que funciona a Wikipédia em português, o que é que tem evoluído, enfim, as várias vantagens que têm sido dadas também ao mundo português, aqui que envolve também um bocadinho o Brasil, como é que funciona esta relação da Wikipédia em português com o Brasil, que ocupa também uma parte importante desta Wikipédia em português. Portanto, não percam a conversa com este colaborador da Wikipédia em português já amanhã. E pronto, está feito. Este podcast foi criado por mim, João Tomé, e editado por Luís Stoffel. Se gostou do que ouviu, siga-nos nas principais plataformas de podcast. Até ao próximo episódio de Made in Tech, do Dinheiro Vivo.